This is one of the few occasions I actually read something. This is out of the book that we're sold out of now. But if you're interested in buying the book, it's still available through Amazon.com. With impunity in 1938 and 1939, Germany intimidated and devoured Eastern and Western Europe. War officially broke out in September 1939, and the nations of Europe fell like dominoes to the German juggernaut. Britain soon found herself alone in the European theater. Winston Churchill became Prime Minister of Britain in May of 1940, and on July 10 of that year, Hitler's Luftwaffe began its brutal air assaults on Britain. Britain stood alone against the Nazi regime until the United States entered the war on December 7, 1941. It is within this context, the United States entered the war on October 29, 1941, that Winston Churchill visited his private education alma mater, Harrow School, to listen to the songs for which Harrow was famous and which gave him encouragement in the face of the adversity. Within the setting of that visit, Churchill delivered his famous speech. "You cannot tell from appearances how things will go. Sometimes imagination makes things out far worse than they are. Yet without imagination, not much can be done. Those people who are imaginative see many more dangers than perhaps exist, certainly many more than will happen. But then they must also pray to be given that extra courage to carry this far-reaching imagination. But for everyone, surely what we have gone through in this period, surely this period of 10 months, this is the lesson. Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy." Most of us who are familiar at all with Winston Churchill have a lot of admiration for him and for what he did, and to serve as the catalyst by which then Western civilization and even the peace of the world eventually was reestablished, at least to some degree. Churchill had the resolve to stand alone against the Nazis. I don't know what the attitude of the British people was, but certainly he was the focal point and the rallying personality around whom they would have sent up their cry. Hezekiah in the Old Testament is sort of a Churchill, and hence I would describe him as the Churchill of Judah. And what I want to do in this discussion in this period, which thank you for the extra time because this is usually the longer session, is to look at some of the things that Hezekiah does in order to prepare for the arrival of the Assyrians. Because the Assyrians are, for the ancient world, not only the Nazis, but also in our modern world of today, the ISIS of the ancient world. But I've got to set the scene here. Assyria represented, and its territorial dominance is within this black circle. And the area is what we would call landlocked. And by that I mean it's exposed on all sides. It has no natural barriers to serve as protection. Babylonia down south doesn't have to worry about anybody invading them from the central part there because nobody lived out there. Hardly anybody lives out there these days except for the oil that is available in that area. Babylonia didn't have to worry about people invading from this direction because seafaring was not very well developed and certainly for war purposes was not very well developed. So Babylonia only had to be concerned about basically the enemy that would be to the north and to the northeast and to the east. Assyria, on the other hand, is exposed on all sides. And invasions had historically come from all directions. But in the middle of the 9th century BC, a king comes to the throne by the name of Ashurnasirpal. You do not have to remember that name. If you were in one of my classes at Harding, not only would you have to remember it, but you'd also have to know how to spell it. So be happy you're off the hook. But Ashurnasirpal comes to the throne, and he begins a different kind of strategy, a strategy of preemptive strikes by which he's going to attack the neighbors before they have a chance to attack him. part of this is for their own security. If we can weaken all of the people surrounding us, then they will not be able to muster the force and the military strength to attack us. But also at the same time, you're going to be dipping into their resources, stealing their gold and silver and grain. You'll be taking some of them off into slavery, as well as decimating their population through death and so forth. And so you will immediately have an avenue by which to theoretically have a large, well-funded machine of security and safety. Well, this kind of thing is not particularly unusual. But what Nashurnazarpal does is he begins doing this with a significant public relations strategy of intimidation. One of my profs at the University of Arizona referred to him as a campaign of fright, calculated frightfulness, in which they would attempt deliberately to scare their enemy into submission. This is a description by which Ashurnazarpal describes one of his sieges. I approached the fortified city of Hulaya. With the mass of my troops and my fierce battle, I besieged and conquered the city. I felled with the sword 800 of their combat troops. I burnt 3,000 captives from them. I did not leave one of them alive as a hostage. I captured alive Hulaya, the city ruler, and I made a pile of corpses, and I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. I flayed Hulaya, their city ruler, and draped his skin over the wall of the city, Damdamusa. I razed, destroyed, and burnt the city. Pretty graphic description of the treatment of the enemy. But what makes this a little bit different than typical kinds of routine warfare, in which these kinds of behaviors are very common, is he's using this as a public relations strategy before he arrives. He's describing what he's done in other places in order to scare people into surrender. Warfare tends oftentimes to bring out the worst in some people. In World War II, we would occasionally hear the reports drifting out of the atrocities that the Nazis were perpetrating upon so many under their rule. But most people in the Western countries just, you know, that can't be the case. Surely people are not that cruel to be treating others in this fashion. And it wasn't until the liberation of Dachau and Treblinka and Auschwitz and other concentration camps that the real horror of what the Nazis had done fell so devastatingly upon the psyche of humanity. But in this case, Ashurnazarpal is using it before the attack. He's doing it like ISIS does it. Let's behead a bunch of folks and put it on video and send it out to scare people into submission. And that's exactly what the mindset of ISIS is. They're tapping into exactly the same strategy that characterized the ancient Assyrians. Ashurnazarpal goes on, I approached the city of Tela. I felled 3,000 of their fighting men with a sword. I carried off captives from them. I captured many troops alive. I cut off of some their arms and hands. I cut off of others their noses, ears, and extremities. I gouged out the eyes of many troops. I made one pile of living and one of heads. I don't know exactly what that means, but it doesn't sound good, no matter how you look at it. I hung their heads on trees around the city. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. And it sounds like he doesn't get along well with teenagers. But the issue here is not that. The issue is there is no more humiliating, defeating thing that you can do to the psyche of a parent than to make the parent watch their children be killed. And that's what this is all about. A deflating attempt. But the description is just graphic. But the trouble is, most people in the ancient world didn't read Akkadian. Now, if you've ever tried to study Akkadian, you can understand why most people didn't. It's not a very easy language to learn. So they didn't limit their braggadocio in just verbal descriptions. They depicted it on various pieces of art. We have representations of this from Ashurnazarpal himself, but perhaps more notable is this one that you might be familiar with from art history class or Bible dictionary, where Ashurbanipal, who's a different king now, Ashurbanipal lives about 200 years after Ashurnazarpal, but Ashurbanipal is reclining on his couch with his queen sitting on a chair in front of him. The servants are on the front and back with their palm fronds to keep them cool, you know, to keep the breeze moving, keep the flies off, keep them cool in the face of this heat. Then there's a nice brush arbor that is over them with the portrayal of the plants to provide shade. Everything is so nice and serene and comfortable. And in the art history classes, they will often show this is some of the finest art of the ancient world. And it is, except for what is being depicted. Then there is the classic Paul Harvey, then there's the rest of the story. And the rest of the story is the rest of the depiction. And in this, if you look on this tree over here, there's the head of a king hanging in the tree. Because this serene scene on the right-hand side is depicting the victory over the king of Elam, and he's portraying this in artwork so that when people come and visit, they can look at this and say, look at what this king has done and how he has treated others. Maybe we ought to have some second thoughts when we think about resisting the Assyrians and their military might. Well, it's within the context of this, sandwiched between Ashurbanipal and Ashurnasirpal, that Hezekiah comes to the throne. Now, the Assyrians and their might has fluctuated a bit through time, as is typically the case with the superpowers. But Hezekiah is facing another period within that of a very systematized, powerful attack. And Hezekiah is a man of faith. He's a man who believes God, who trusts God, and recognizes that we as a people of God have not been worshiping and serving God properly. And he wants to get Israel, or more specifically Judah, back on track. And we can look at four things that he does to try to prepare for the arrival of the Assyrians. Now, I do not want to suggest that he does these simply in some sort of a manipulative kind of way. I think he's functioning as a person of faith from the get-go, but he also recognizes we have a responsibility to do what we can. Among those are religious reforms. He wants to try to get Judah back to worship God properly. The Bible will repeatedly talk in terms of the children of Israel and Judah worshiping at high places away from Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the place where they're supposed to bring their sacrifices and their offerings, Deuteronomy chapter 12. Jerusalem is the focal point of their worship and where Yahweh lives, although he certainly is everywhere. But this is where God has chosen that worship be conducted. And so he makes a serious effort to try to get rid of the competing places of worship and the altars of sacrifice scattered elsewhere throughout the country. He also wants to stockpile food in anticipation of the military machine of the Assyrians. One of the things that the Assyrians were very good at was encircling a town and choking it off and killing it through siege warfare. And if you can hold out long enough, maybe they will wear down and leave, although that usually was rarely the case. He also wants to strengthen the fortifications and stockpile weapons to have those on hand to try to the best of his ability to protect his people against attacks. And he also wants to secure the water supply, particularly of Jerusalem, because it was through the water supply of Jerusalem that Jerusalem originally was taken into custody by David himself. And surely Hezekiah is familiar with that earlier capture of the city by David. Archaeologically, we can look at each one of these things, and what I want to do is exactly that in the course of this discussion. A typical attack to the land of Canaan, Judah, would typically come along the coast because it's easier to travel along that way, and along the way you systematically wipe out and subjugate the towns that you encounter. The more towns that fall, the less morale there will be remaining among those who have not been defeated. And so if you come down the way and capture all of these, hopefully you can demoralize the people in the city in the central part and in Jerusalem so that you will not need to take your army in to fight against them. So this is the way typically the attacks will come down along the coast, whether it's the Assyrians, whether it's the Babylonians, whether it's the Persians, whether it's the Greeks, whether it's the Romans, whether it's the Sassanians. The exceptions would be the Egyptians for fairly obvious reasons. But then they would make a turn and move inward. And it's at the site of Lachish where the Assyrians are going to be focusing their attention, having captured 46 fortified cities of Judah. Now they're working on Lachish and the hope that they can get Jerusalem to surrender. Now, if you have your Bibles, I encourage you to turn with me. I want to read a rather lengthy passage with some commentary. Turn to Isaiah chapter 36. And I'm going to read parts of this and then stop along the way and make some comments about some passages. Now, to set the scene, the military commander of the Assyrians has come to Jerusalem. And he's outside the city wall. He's referred to in the biblical text as the Rabshakeh. The New International Version will refer to him as the field commander, which is a suitable description of what that role is. Rabshakeh is not the personal name of an individual. It's the name of an office, if you will. And field commander is a suitable representation of that. So the Rabshakeh comes with a contingency of the army. And they are outside of the city of Jerusalem. They don't come with the intent of attacking Jerusalem at this point, but as a show of force and to offer the terms of surrender. Because if they would surrender, things would go reasonably well for the people of Jerusalem. Some of them might be taken away and captured, but for the most part, they would be left alive with a tribute imposed upon them to pay the king off and so forth and so on. And if they don't continue to submit to the Assyrian rule, then the Assyrians will come back and brutalize them. If they don't surrender at the get-go, they'll be brutalized from the start. That's the basic strategy. Hezekiah does not go out to meet them himself. He sends his own representatives. This is on the second tier of, you know, it's neither the king talking to the king, it's the king's representatives talking to the king's representatives. You know, my people will talk to your people kind of thing. And so in this scenario, Hezekiah sends out his representatives with an entourage, and they're outside of the city wall within earshot of the wall. Now, this is going to become clear in the narrative. Now, you can imagine the folks in Jerusalem are curious as to how this is going to play out, because in a very real sense, their lives are in the balance. This is in 701 BC. It's 20 years after the northern kingdom of Samaria has fallen to the hands of the Assyrians. A lot of refugees from Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, had fled to Judah, and I'm sure bringing tales with them of what the Assyrians had done and how they had behaved. And certainly the news would have gotten back to Jerusalem. So they're probably up on the wall straining their ears to hear this conversation. Okay, do you have this sort of set in mind? This is going to come into the narrative. We pick up in verse 4. And the Rabshakeh said to them, "Say to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, on what do you rest this trust of yours? Do you think that mere words are strategy and power for war? In whom do you now trust that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you are trusting in Egypt, that broken reed of a staff which will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him." So he's trying to intimidate them. The alliances you're trying to make are going to be worthless, so you might as well quit attempting to make those connections. "But if you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has removed, saying to Judah and to Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar'?" Now this demonstrates that they know what Hezekiah has done, that he's made an attempt to try to get rid of these other altars. But it's clear that he does not know the religious law of God, that Jerusalem was the place where they were supposed to bring the sacrifices and not just offer sacrifices anywhere. But the Rabshakeh is looking at Hezekiah's attempts as basically an affront to Yahweh. "Come now, make a wager with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them." Now, are there still Kmarts around here? Okay, I haven't been in a Kmart in years. Do they still have the blue light special? That's basically what this is. This is a blue light special. The first 2,000 folks that come out the city gate will give you a horse, will let you live. You're going to be living somewhere else, but you'll be alive. Then after 2,000, then, you know, we cut it off, the rest of you die. Now, the population of Jerusalem at this point is probably about 12,000. So if 2,000 of the individuals suddenly leave, you can imagine how demoralizing that would be for the rest of the folks. prompting them perhaps then to be more amenable to surrender. How then can you repulse a single captain among the least of my master's servants when you trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Moreover, is it without the Lord that I have come up against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Now, this raises a question. Did God tell the Assyrians to do this explicitly? I can't say he didn't, but then on the other hand, I can't say that he did. But what I can say with confidence, and what we can know, is that Isaiah has been telling Judah that the Lord is using the Assyrians as punitive strategies. In Isaiah chapter 10, Isaiah has already informed the people of Israel that God is using Assyria as his rod of anger in his hand. Now, whether God explicitly has told the Assyrians to come and do this or not is open to question. But at least what he's saying dovetails well enough where the people should have sat and thought and realized, huh, we've heard this before. Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joash said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it, but do not speak to us in the language of Judah within the hearing of the people who are on the wall. That's why we know the setting of what is involved here. But the Rabshakeh said to him, has my master sent me to speak these words to your master and to you alone, and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and drink their own urine? That's a pretty graphic description of efforts to try to survive. We're going to choke you out to where you're going to go to desperate ends to try to survive. So then the Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice in the language of Judah, hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord by saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Now skip down to verse 18. Beware lest Hezekiah mislead you by saying that the Lord will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamat and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Now this is what is known as an argument from history. And the problem with an argument from history is that it doesn't always work. But it's a powerful one. Because basically he's asking, what makes your God any different than any of the other gods that you're resisting us and trusting him? Now, if Yahweh were simply other gods, that would be a legitimate question. But Yahweh is not just another god amongst all of these. Who among all of the gods of these lands have delivered their lands out of my hand that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? Interesting tirade. Now, what I want to do through the rest of this and then come back and look at some elements of it is to look at some examples of what Hezekiah did that we can see from art history, that we can see from excavation, and we can see from texts, not just of the Bible, but also other texts. Lachish is where the Rabshakeh went to Jerusalem from. If you open up the discussion there at the beginning of that chapter, it's from Lachish that the Rabshakeh goes to Jerusalem. This is an aerial view of Lachish looking toward the northeast. It's not a very large site. None of the towns in Israel are very large. The largest town in Israel is about 200 acres. So we're talking small and not necessarily real dense populations within them. But about 200 acres. This is about 15 acres or so. So fairly small. Now that doesn't exclude some people living outside the city, but for the most part they lived inside the town and would go out into the fields to work like we talked about yesterday. Now, it doesn't look really particularly imposing until you get down here looking at it and think in terms of the hill being surmounted around the perimeter with walls that are 15, 20, 30 feet high. And so as you look at this, there would be walls 15, 20, 30 feet high. Now imagine trying to scramble up the side of that in order to undermine the wall that's sitting up there at the top. And the people pouring oil on you and dumping, you know, water on you, probably not water, but shooting arrows at you, throwing stones at you, anything they can do to try to make you lose your footing and die. And of course, that's the way all of this would tend to unfold. Well, Sennacherib eventually did defeat Lachish. That's also indicated in this chapter. After the Rabshakeh leaves Jerusalem, he goes back and reconnects with Sennacherib at Libna, because he's already captured by that point Lachish. But Sennacherib refers to, in this prism, this is a document that you can see if you go to the University of Chicago Oriental Institute Museum, or another copy of it in the British Museum in London. And when I talk about copies, these are, neither of them are replicas of modern making. These are duplicates of the document from the time of Sennacherib. He had multiple copies made. And one's in Chicago, one's in the British Museum. But in this text, he talks about having captured 46 fortified cities of Judah. If you read the narrative in the Bible will talk about him having captured all the fortified cities of Judah. Now, interestingly, Jerusalem is excluded from this. And Jerusalem is not mentioned as being captured by Sennacherib on this document. Nor is Jerusalem captured in the narrative, according to the narrative of the Bible. What is interesting is what he does say about Jerusalem. But I'm going to put that on hold till we get to the end. But Sennacherib is so proud of his conquest of Lachish that he commemorates it back in his palace in Nineveh. Okay? This is a drawing of part of his palace at Nineveh. To give you some sense of scale, over here you have a scale up the side. This is 100 meters. 100 meters is slightly longer than 100 yards, think in terms of a football field. And the complex that is all involved here. The room we're going to be looking at is that one right there. So there's this large courtyard, D, and you go through this series of doors into this room that is known as number 36. And in that room, which is a throne room, he represents the besiegement and conquest of the city of Lachish in Judah. So apparently he was impressed with what he did himself. As you go into this, you're going to go through those doorways with these imposing figures that are designed to intimidate you. Dignitaries from other countries are going to come in and see the king in the throne room, and as they make their way, they have plenty of time to think and think about the grandeur of the palace. And they begin looking at the artwork and the portrayal and everything else. And when they finally get the audience with the king and finally are released, they're going to go back home and say, you know, we'd better stop and think about what we're doing when we resist the Assyrians, because they're mighty mean folks. And their artwork often will show it. Now, this is a portrayal, an artist's rendering of going down there. And as you go into the throne room, if you start scanning around the room, you'll see these reliefs, these drawings. This one is not real clear. It's a monochrome color. Originally, these were painted in color, and we know that by the fact that there's still paint clinging in certain areas of the relief. These are in the British Museum. If you ever make it to London, I highly recommend that you go see these. But you can see a couple of individuals over there in sort of odd positions. They're being flayed. Now, mind you, this is something that is on, this is basically the wallpaper in the throne room. When people come to visit, they get to look at this. This individual over here is having basically his, you know, major artery in his upper neck or lower neck being sliced open and bled out. Another way to help people recognize your power and your might. As you scan on around, there are these portrayal of these three guys who are being impaled, with these posts about 3 inches or so in diameter underneath the rib cage and then lifted up to dangle. Again, this is not something that's squirreled away in some hidden archive. It's not the kind of thing, have these been declassified and made accessible to us. This is a public display. This is designed to intimidate. Everybody can come in, if you're granted an audience with the king, everybody would be able to see this and to take a message back. And one reason we know what's under consideration is the portrayal of the king receiving the dignitaries of the captured city of Lachish, and his description in this inscription up here on the upper left, which translates to Sennacherib, king of the world, king of Assyria, sitting on his throne while the spoil from the city of Lachish passed before him. Well, excavations at the site of Lachish have not shown there to be any conflict with what the portrayal is. And I've only shown you a small snippet of all of this. The entire artwork involves siege ramps, these scenes that we've described. It shows and depicts the richness of the terrain, the embattlement of the city, people throwing torches back and forth, volleys of arrows being tossed and shot, sling balls and stones being cast back and forth. I mean, it's really a wild and active kind of scene. Well, one of the things that the Assyrians do is build a siege ramp in order to get siege machines up to the wall to batter the walls down, remnants of which still exist. Half of this was excavated back in the 1930s, and then there were resumed excavations in the 1980s. And this is a section of the siege ramp that was by design to reduce the angle from a steeper angle to one that is less steep. It's still rather dramatically steep. I would not be one wanting to move a siege machine into place. But in the excavations, they found sling stones. By the way, sling stones are not your stereotypical view of David and Goliath and the size of marbles. Sling stones, typically at minimum, were the size of tennis balls, up to the size of softballs, which can potentially change the whole drama of what you imagine with David and Goliath. But these are some sling stones that were found in the siege ramp. These are arrowheads made out of bone and arrowheads of bronze and iron that were found in the siege ramp. I've often wondered how many times did some of these arrowheads make a trip back and forth? Because you can imagine if one comes from the Assyrians, it lands intact, they're going to shoot it back and back and forth. But then there's the question of why some of them made out of bone. Well, I'm inclined to think that the bone ones are made after the animals have died and they take a long bone and they turn some of the long bones into arrowheads because they need the armament. And this gives an intensification of the drama of the besiegement of the city at the hands of the Assyrians. Another thing that Hezekiah is described as doing is stockpiling food. You can look at texts within the pages of the Bible that describe this very fleetingly, I might add. But this is the excavation down at the site of Beersheba. And in the excavation of these storage buildings that were built at the time of Hezekiah, they found the rooms chock full of ceramic vessels that were holding grain and had held wine and water and oil and so forth that had been destroyed by the Assyrians. But another thing that they discovered were some peculiar stones. Now, if you look at this, you can see this very distinctly squared stone, a squared stone, but then others that are not squared. These are just field stones lying around. And then there's an unusually shaped stone here in the middle, a squared stone, but then other stones that are just field stones. Well, it turns out those very distinctly shaped stones are stones that belong to a four-horned altar. And this, what happened was Hezekiah, in his religious reform, is trying to get rid of those altars, to which, by the way, the Rabshakeh refers. Okay, remember him indicting Hezekiah for getting rid of all of these altars? Well, Hezekiah got rid of the altars as best he could, but rather than just throw those stones away, they're going to recycle them. Recycling is not a new idea here. They're going to recycle them as building material in building storage facilities in which they would store food to try to prepare for the arrival of the Assyrians. I mean, this is not stupid. This is a perfectly legitimate kind of approach by which to deal with all of this. In the excavation of the site at Beersheba, as well as other locations, including Beth Shemesh, we would occasionally find jars that would have this impression stamped on the handle. These are referred to usually as lamellic store jar handles. And the lamellic store jars are store jars that belong to the king, hence the belonging to the king. That's what the phrase lamellic means. And then there would be a reference to various towns. So it would have lamellic up here, and then the name of one of four towns down on the lower register. And at Beth Shemesh, we have found dozens of these as well in a destruction level about this far below the surface. So we dig down about 8 inches and we hit this Sennacherib destruction level with dozens of these jar handles where they apparently were processing the oil then that would be shipped off to other locations. We have no evidence that Bet-Shemesh was one of those fortified cities that Sennacherib referred to. This is what a lot of these jars look like after we have glued them back together. Again, we prefer them not to be broken, but hey, things do get broken in the process of destruction and excavation. In the city of Jerusalem, one of the things that Hezekiah has to deal with is the security of his people. And here we have, this is the old original city of David, the southern part right down here. This is the part that David captures. It expands northward with Solomon, and they build the temple up here on Mount Moriah. The wall that extends out to the west over here is a wall extension that is put into play during the time of Hezekiah, apparently to accommodate the swelled population as the refugees have fled from the northern kingdom and come down into the country of Judah. But Hezekiah wants to protect them as best he can. And one of the things that he does is build what is known as the Broad Wall. In the book of Nehemiah, when Nehemiah goes on the restoration of the building of the walls, there's a reference to the Broad Wall and where the Broad Wall came into the wall that Nehemiah and the Israelites rebuilt. It's called the Broad Wall because it's thick. And the Israelites were not always real creative in how they name things. They would tend to name them sort of what they are. So if you have a real thick wall, it's a broad wall. It'd be sort of like if you had a cat, you'd name it cat. Or if you had a dog, you'd name it dog. If you've ever watched that John Wayne movie years ago, always loved that one, dog. You'd almost think he was an Israeli in doing that. But to give you some impression as to how big this wall is, there's an artifact on here that should serve as a point of scale. You ready? That's the wall. But that point of reference is this 2-liter Coke bottle. And you might be able to see the red label on it. All of us know how big a 2-liter Coke bottle is. And the fact that you can hardly see that thing on this wall should give you some idea of how thick the wall is. It's about 25 feet thick. Hence appropriately named a broad wall. One of the interesting things in this slide are these walls over here to the right. And if you look carefully and think about this, it's clear that this big broad wall is built on top of those. These are taken out of use and that's built and just setting right on top of it. So that you'd have, for instance, here are the earlier walls, and they take the broad wall and it's resting on it like that. This is a classic case of stratification. But there's also an allusion to this in Isaiah chapter 22 where Isaiah indicts the people of Judah for placing their confidence in the fortifications, where you've torn down the houses in order to build the fortifications. And this is a classic example of where they had torn down the buildings, the houses, in order to build the fortifications. Now, Hezekiah is not being indicted here. The children of Israel, for their confidence in the military regime, is what is being indicted. The city water supply was the last item to consider. This is looking southward along the Kidron Valley. The Kidron Valley is down at the bottom. And this is the city of David. This is the city of David and the top of the Ophel. Now, the old fortification walls would have been situated about right there so that there's outside the city, that's inside the city. Now this comes back to our water supply system issue that we talked about yesterday. The water supply for Jerusalem is underneath that building that you barely see on the edge of the slide right there, outside the city. Why did they build the city wall upslope rather than accommodating that to within the city wall itself? Well, maybe the next slide will show you. That's where the spring is. You hit the bottom of this and you immediately have a slope that starts up the other side. And if you tried to build a city wall down here in the bottom of the valley that would be high enough to be viable, it would be structurally so weak that it would be worthless. So you functionally have to build the city wall up slope, but that's going to leave the old spring exposed. 2 Samuel chapter 5 describes how David and his army got through and captured the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites through the water system. And I'm sure that Hezekiah is familiar with that history. And he does not want the Assyrians to replicate this. So he's going to try to secure the water supply to make it accessible to the people in Jerusalem from within the security of the walled city. But in order to do that requires some work. Here's where the spring is represented. That's the city wall running along the side of the Kidron Valley. And the spring is outside of the city. So he's going to dig a tunnel, goes underneath the spur of ground, and goes serpentine route down here eventually to the Pool of Siloam. Distance involved here is about 1,750 feet, or about 6 football fields long. It's fascinating to go through this. And you can still go through it. And the excavators, not the modern excavators, but the ancient makers of this thing, began with one crew on one end and another crew on the other end, and they dug toward each other, hoping to meet in the middle somewhere. And as you make your trip through this, you go down this flight of steps, and the spring and water comes out from underneath that. This is looking back at that flight of steps, and the water's flowing down toward me, and you begin walking through the tunnel. There are no lights in the tunnel. You have to take a good flashlight with you, all right? Most of the tunnel is taller than this. Okay, I like this picture because there's not many places I have to duck, so I wanted to take advantage of that as a photograph. But the water level is usually about mid-calf somewhere down there. Occasionally it might be higher. There's a place at the beginning where it gets sort of high up, and then you climb back up. But you walk through it, and the width of this is almost always consistently just about what you see here, slightly wider than shoulders. But as you walk through this, you can see, if you look carefully, you can see some vertical lines, or at least what look like vertical lines here. Can you see that? Those are actually arcs where the people have come along with their adzes and have chipped away at the stone. And you can see the curvature of the adze marks as they've chipped the stone away and then filled up the buckets, transported it back through a probably fire brigade kind of thing, and then keep chipping away, keep chipping and passing the stone chips back and so forth. Once you get past the middle of this, those arc marks are coming back toward you. So they're digging chip, 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 chip. They get to a point where they can hear each other chipping away and maybe even speaking, and they begin to make some adjustments. And you get to the middle of this, and it sort of goes helter-skelter different directions, and then it smooths back out as they are following a fairly consistent kind of strategy. Toward the end of the tunnel, there was this inscription. This is now in the Istanbul Museum. It was discovered in the late 1800s by a couple of boys playing in the tunnel. And the inscription reads, "While there were still 3 cubits to be cut through, there was heard the voice of a man calling to his fellow. And when the tunnel was driven through, the quarrymen hewed the rock, each man toward his fellow, axe against axe, and the water flowed from the spring toward the reservoir for 1,200 cubits." And the water goes into a reservoir known as the Pool of Siloam, which is referred to in John chapter 9. Now that episode in John 9 is where there is this man who is born blind. And the disciples ask him, "Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he's been born blind?" And Jesus says, neither of these circumstances is the case, but that you may know the power of God. And then he makes this mud pack of soil and spittle and puts the mud pack on the guy's eyes, and he tells them, and it depends on your Bible translation as to how they'll do this, and he tells them, "Go wash in the Pool of Siloam," which by interpretation means sent. Now most people read this to think Jesus tells them to go to the Pool of Siloam because he's sending him to the Pool of Siloam. That's not what the point means. The Pool of Siloam means the pool sent. It is sent pool because the water is not from a spring. It is water that is sent there through a tunnel that's 1,750 feet long. And so this comes into the narration of the life of Jesus in a secondary, very significantly secondary kind of way. But this is the remnant of the pool as it may now be seen. Much of it is still buried underneath the overburden of the debris through the centuries. Now, I mentioned that prism that is in the British Museum and the University of Chicago Museum, in which Hezekiah loses 46 fortified cities. Well, the way the story ends, Hezekiah is resolved not to surrender. Chapter 36 will point out that the Rabshakeh returns to the king, but the king has finished defeating Lachish. He's moved to Libna. And now he gives Hezekiah a second chance to surrender. So he sends another letter. And in chapter 37, verse 14, Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed to the Lord, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see, and hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So now, O Lord, our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are the Lord. Well, the Lord is very pleased with this prayer of faith. And he tells Isaiah to go back in and deliver this message to Hezekiah. Verse 33. Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city or shoot an arrow there, or come before it with a shield or cast up a siege mound against it. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return. And he shall not come into the city, declares the Lord. For I will defend the city to save it, for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. And the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the people arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. And Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. And I might add, never to come back to Jerusalem again. Sennacherib in that prism says something about Hezekiah, specifically. He'll talk about capturing 46 fortified cities. But you remember, you have to remember, put this in context. The Assyrians love to brag about what they'd done. But they couldn't quite bring themselves overtly to lie. Okay? Maybe they realized that there are some people that were truth and fact checkers around. So they couldn't quite bring themselves overtly to lie. So what he says about Hezekiah is, I shut up Hezekiah in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. Well, in a sense, the two accounts mesh. They mesh well enough that Assyrians, yes, it's not Hezekiah, it's not Sennacherib that shut him up, but nonetheless, he did not capture the city of Jerusalem. But yet at the same time, Jerusalem is delivered and salvaged from destruction because of the faith of Hezekiah. I don't know if this story is true or not, but I remember, for some reason, hearing this account. Back in the days of the old Cold War, the Soviet Union and the United States would occasionally do something to try to show that we're trying to make some progress of getting along. And back in the 60s or so, there was supposed to have been, as I remember it, a track meet, which was innocuous enough. You know, track meets are not known for their extreme violence. And there was some track meet in which were involved only two countries, the United States and the Soviet Union. We won the track meet. Okay. But the Russians, the Soviets, report to their population along this line. There was a track meet that took place, May 31st, second or 31st and, you know, 1967, in which there were two countries involved, the United States and the Soviet Union, and the United States came in next to last. And the Soviet Union came in second. Well, that's sort of the way these two accounts mesh. If you listen to what is being said, the Assyrians tweak it very significantly in their direction, but it's not an overt lie. But the Bible talks in terms about what really happened. It wasn't the military prowess of the Israelites that saved them. It was the faith and confidence of Hezekiah. And God did salvage them in the face of this, to the point that 185,000 soldiers of the Assyrians die in an overnight attack by an angel of the Lord. And he decides, you know, maybe we ought to go home. But he commemorates the battle in his palace back in Nineveh. Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never give in. I think you can see why I might think of Hezekiah as the Churchill of Judah. The entire, pardon the phrase, in this town, the deck was stacked against him as far as purely military issues are concerned. The only thing he had on his side was God. But hey, when you got God on your side, what more do you really need? And that's where the issue of faith really becomes important. Hezekiah did everything that he could, did as far as he could. He wasn't going to leave it purely in God's hands. He was going to be a cooperative subject. But when push comes to shove, he realizes, Lord, I've done all I can do. It's yours now. We live in a world in which the temptations and the pressures to capitulate to sin are overwhelming. Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never. Thank you.